from West Virginia Public Broadcasting.
Support for the legislature today is provided by the following.
West Virginia University, online at wvu.edu. AARP West Virginia, your ally for real possibilities in the Mountain State. Online at aarp.org/wv. The West Virginia Higher Education Policy Commission, working to double the degrees produced annually in our state by 2025. Through increased opportunities for West Virginians to earn the credentials today's economy demands. The High Technology Foundation, building a stronger West Virginia. Online at wvhtf.org.
At the legislature today, senators approve a bill to drug test welfare recipients, but are still struggling with one that would increase campaign contribution limits. In the House, members are attempting for the third year in a row to figure out what to do with a Jackson County Conference Center. And State Auditor Glenn Gaynor joins us to discuss the new state computer system lawmakers threatened to delay. Those stories and more coming up on the legislature today. Good evening, I'm Ashton Mara. The Senate Judiciary Committee worked into the evening yesterday on a bill increasing the donor contribution limits in West Virginia elections from the current $1,000 cap to $2,700, the federal contribution limit. Yesterday, Democratic Senator Mike Woeful stood on the chamber floor to raise concerns over the original legislation, saying he's been watching presidential town halls across the country and believes this bill goes against public opinion.
And when I watch these town halls, the folks say Washington is the problem. And the basis for our bill today is we want to be like Washington and come up to $2,700 per person per donation. We want to mimic what they do over there in the district, which makes no sense to me. The other thing I hear from the town hall meetings is, money is corrupting our system. And these invisible donors that play a shell game from corporation to candidate, are a big problem in our country. And I really would like to see some support from across the aisle on this. I can't believe that on this important issue of campaign finance, that we're going to come down to a 16-18 vote again. Last year, we did have bipartisan support to control the obscene money that comes into elections in our country. So I'll ask the fair-minded members of the majority party, please examine your conscience and see if you can't get behind full disclosure in West Virginia. Thank you.
The Judiciary Committee made some changes to the bill yesterday, including some proposed by Senator Woeful. Joining me to discuss this legislation is the Senate Judiciary Committee's chair, Senator Charles Trump, and a Democratic member of the committee, Senator Mike Romano. Thank you both for being here this evening.
Good to be here.
Thank you, Ashton.
Let's start with some of those changes that were made in the committee yesterday. Senator, can you explain to me what happened?
Well, it was a 2 or 3 hour process, so condensing that into a couple minutes would be difficult. But we laid the introduced bill or a committee substitute on the table in the committee, and members offered amendments, as is our process. And there were, I think, five amendments that were adopted over the course of several hours of discussion in the committee.
So one of those is an amendment that came from Senator Woeful increasing the reporting. Why is that an issue that's important for Democrats, Senator?
Well, I think it really should be an issue that's important for all of us. It was certainly the amendment that we made last year and got broad bipartisan support, and it's a sunshine amendment that simply allows people to know where the kind of hateful speech that we see in all of our elections is coming from. To judge speech, you have to know where it's coming from and who's financing it. And this bill simply does that. It has very plain and easy disclosure requirements that when a certain amounts of money are spent on any type of electioneering speech, which is attacking a candidate or supporting a candidate, you see those really fancy names like, you know, the free for the free, but you don't really know who's spending the money to send you that message. For voters to make a decision, they have to know where that message is coming from. That's what this bill, this amendment would have done, just like it would have done last year.
Yeah, Senator, this was included in the version of the bill last year. Do you expect it to stick?
I don't know. If you remember last year, Ashton, when that got included in the bill, and Mike's right, we did have it in the bill last year and sent it to the House of Delegates, the bill collapsed and it didn't pass over there. And some of the feedback we got was that those provisions of the bill that Senator Wolfel was successful in our committee in amending into our committee substitute were part of the reason for that. There's a distinction to be drawn, an important difference. The bill we started with had a very narrow purpose, and it dealt with the money that candidates can raise and use in elections, as opposed to Senator Wolfel's amendment, which was much broader and didn't relate to contributions to campaigns. Those are already required under the law to be disclosed and would be required to be disclosed under the bill we had before us. The issue addressed by Senator Wolfel's amendment is expenditures by independent, unrelated parties. And quite frankly, I think we probably have some agreement on the fact that so much of that occurs, it almost deprives the candidates themselves of the opportunity to control the message for their campaigns. And so that was the fundamental purpose of the bill, to address the limits for the candidates, giving them more control of the message as opposed to these outside groups or parties that operate in the ether apart from the candidates themselves.
Is the disclosure requirements a sticking point for you all? Are you not willing to give that up?
Absolutely. We went through the same process last year. Last year, the bill started with unlimited campaign contribution limits. We indicated that the Democrats certainly couldn't be a part of that, and there didn't seem to be enough force on the other side to do it without us. So we compromised. It came down to the federal limits, which is still injecting more and more money into these campaigns. But the root of all evil is money. And money is corrupting our political process. And these independent expenditures are the root of that evil. It's where very rich people can send a message to voters who are catching a tidbit on TV and making decisions based on basically little news clips. And they're spending millions of dollars to put those into the state. The funding for these independent expenditures, as they have called, have gone up by almost, I mean, just tens of millions of dollars in the last election cycle because of a case called Citizens United that allows unlimited expenditures by corporations and these huge donors to really get out and try to influence our voters. And voters need to know, just like they need to know who's making the campaign contributions to the candidates, they need to know who's behind these messages. And I see them just intertwined with each other. And I understand the chairman's point that, you know, they tried to just do something on candidate campaign expenditures, but you can't do that. If you want to do the right thing, and I believe Charlie agreed with this last year and agreed with me, that these disclosure requirements had to be in there for independent expenditures in order to make our elections fair. If you let rich people buy the election and hide behind fancy-sounding, you know, entity names, nonprofit entities, you're not going to understand what the message is, and you might be persuaded to vote against your own best interests.
So, Senator, I just want to ask, you know, the bill didn't move out of committee yesterday, and there's some speculation that because of this addition, it won't move at all. What's going to happen with this
bill? Well, it's too early to say that for sure, I think. We're definitely going to have to check with the House of Delegates and see whether or not that bill, you know, as I say, it's pretty close. There are some other changes to it that make it somewhat different from the bill the Senate passed last year to the House that wasn't enacted into law last year. So I think we're going to need to look and see whether or not there's if the changes that have been made to it are going to prevent its passage. I don't know the answer to that yet, Ashton, but we have a great committee out there in the West Wing, and Mike, of course, and Mike Wolfel, whom you showed earlier, are valuable members of that committee on whom I rely for their judgment on many questions, and we'll work together and find the answer to that.
Senate Judiciary Chair Charles Trump, Senator Mike Romano, thank you both for being here.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
In a bipartisan vote, members of the West Virginia Senate approved a bill that sets up a drug testing process for recipients of public assistance. It's a measure some senators say will help identify West Virginians who need the substance abuse treatment they can't get on their own. But for others, it forces needy West Virginians to pay for a service they can't afford. Drug testing welfare recipients is not a new concept. Members of the West Virginia legislature considered the proposal last session, but for 13 other states, the program is a reality. West Virginia's proposed law would focus on TANF recipients, the Temporary Assistance for Needy Families program. Senator Ryan Ferns is the bill's lead sponsor and the chamber's health committee chair. He explains the bill requires the West Virginia Department of Health and Human Resources to seek federal approval and oversee the program, which they predict will cost $50,000 in the first year. Fern says DHHR employees must have, quote, a reasonable suspicion before they can submit a TANF recipient for testing.
And reasonable suspicion is defined in two ways. If during the screening process the applicant demonstrates qualities indicative of substance abuse, that is one method. The second would be a prior conviction of a drug-related offense within the past 5 years.
Fern says the bill creates a three-strike system. After one failed drug test, recipients must enroll in rehabilitation and workforce training programs, but get to keep their benefits. They lose those benefits after a second failed test. But after 12 months or completing a rehabilitation or job training program, whichever is shorter, they'll get their benefits back. It's after a third failed drug test, Fern says, the recipient loses those benefits for life. Senators on both sides of the aisle stood in support of the measure, including Democrat Herb Snyder, who says he was opposed to the bill until he thought about the number of babies born in the state addicted to drugs.
Now, maybe those that say that maybe this isn't the answer, it is not the answer. But it is an epidemic that is affecting newborn babies in this state. And for that reason, I support this bill and urge this legislature and all the people of West Virginia, we need to work together to work on solutions for this drug problem.
Republican Senator Craig Blair says he was the first member of the West Virginia legislature to introduce similar legislation more than 10 years ago when he was a member of the House. But back then, he says, he was told the bill would never even be considered by the Senate.
That's not the way to solve problems in West Virginia. The way to solve problems in West Virginia is to take them head on, address it, and get it done, and then start reaping the benefits and the rewards. And I can tell you right now that the taxpayers on top of it will appreciate this, because we all want to help those that can't help themselves, but we don't want to help those that won't help themselves. And this puts the mechanism in place that where we can get the help to where they need.
But Senate Minority Leader Jeff Kessler is not comfortable with parts of the bill. He and fellow Democrat Bill Laird were the only senators to vote against it. Kessler says the bill requires the TANF recipient to pay for the drug treatment or rehabilitative service they're required to go through after failing a drug test.
Keep in mind, these are TANF recipients who are indigent already. So where are you going to come up with $500 or $1,000 to enroll in a drug treatment program to receive $150 worth of food stamps?
On top of the payment issue, Kessler says there's a lack of treatment options in many rural parts of the state, leaving a class of people without options.
So we're forcing folks into programs that we're not even sure it exists, number one, and if they do, we're asking people to pay for it that desperately need treatment that don't have the funds to pay for it. So then what?
Kessler says he would support the bill if it required the state to expand access to treatment and to fund those rehabilitative programs for welfare beneficiaries. Ferns told Kessler on the floor that many TANF recipients are also covered by Medicaid, which will pay for drug treatment services. Ferns says the DHHR has assured lawmakers there are also enough of those programs to take in referrals from the new welfare testing system.
Chris Walters is a Republican from Putnam County. He was elected to the West Virginia Senate in 2012 to represent the state's 8th senatorial district. Walters serves as the chair of the Senate Transportation Committee and the vice chair of both the Committees on Government Organization and Finance. Roy Cooper was elected to the House of Delegates in 2012. He's a Republican from Summers County. Delegate Cooper represents the state's 28th House of Delegates district. He serves as the vice chair of the House Veterans Affairs Committee and retired from the U.S. Navy. John O'Neill represents the state's 28th House of Delegates district. He's a Republican from Raleigh County. Delegate O'Neill was first elected to the House in 2010. He serves as the majority whip and was a member of the Interim Joint Select Committee on Tax Reform.
During the interim session, the Legislative Auditor's Office presented a report to lawmakers about a new computer system being implemented across state government. According to the audit report, that system had a bug that would result in the overpayment of tens of millions of dollars in salaries to public employees. Lawmakers threatened to stop the implementation of the multi-million dollar program, but our guest defended it. Joining us now is West Virginia Auditor Glenn Gaynor. Thank you so much for being here.
Well, thank you, Ashton. Glad to be with you this evening.
So we should start by saying that you, along with the governor and the treasurer, have overseen the implementation of West Virginia OASIS.
Yes.
Can you just briefly explain to us, what is this? What does it do?
Well, OASIS is West Virginia moving forward and joining most all the states in the country of operating our financial networks on a single enterprise-wide system, meaning we're all utilizing the same system, the same software, in order to conduct state business. It's about, in total, the 10-year expenditure on this program or project is $197 million. So it is by no means a small project. It's a very large project, literally replacing hundreds of systems across state government.
So this audit of the system was released to lawmakers in October, and in it said the state would spend an extra $50 million in salaries because of a bug in the conversion rate as the state moved from paying its employees twice a month to every other Friday. Yeah. So can you tell us about that bug, about that report?
Well, actually, there's no bug in the system, and I discount that report because that's what it was. It really was not an audit. It was just information gathering that he gathered, and as far as I'm concerned, assembled wrongly. The concern was is how we pay employees. When we put the new system in place, we followed a biweekly pay system. Right now, West Virginia government's paid semi-monthly. Every, twice a month you receive a paycheck. Private sector, in fact, 80% of all employers out there pay, large employers as West Virginia would be, pay biweekly. So we moved into the most efficient way to pay our employees, moving to biweekly. Where the difference comes in is how you deal with the biweekly system that's 26 pays per year. You're paying them for 250 days, 52 weeks, 5 work days on average per week. But you have a couple extra days some years. You have leap years, and you always have an extra day every year. Well, we believed and took the position that we deserve to pay employees for every single day that they work. The legislative auditor took exception with that, saying we're overpaying employees. We're not overpaying employees. Hourly employees were always paid for those days. At the end of the day, we're really talking about $10 million, and that would only be salaried employees, and we believed in treating everyone equally within the new system.
So we're still in the implementation process, and we expect to be done by when?
We hope to go and finish up the HR payroll piece. Right now we have 10 agencies online with the new payroll system, paying them biweekly. We hope to move, again, time capture on the remaining employees in state government in May, and they would see their first biweekly paycheck in June.
So you are already seeing benefits from this OASIS system,
yes.
And you took a report to lawmakers saying, here's some extra money that you all are missing.
Right. Yeah, one thing that OASIS allows us to do is generate a lot of reports and information. It is an information system. It's a system of transparency. So it's designed to provide lawmakers and decision makers with much more granular information so that they can make better decisions. That's why we've invested the money, is to provide this information. So one of the reports that we ran before I went up to give my budget presentation was the surplus appropriation numbers. Every year in the budget bill, there's certain numbers of monies, like my general revenue. If I don't spend it all this year, there's language in the budget that reappropriates that to my office to expend in future years. So I took a report up showing them that over, you know, that those reappropriation monies, which are really extra money in state government, were about $300 million. And we showed them where all that money was at and that a lot of that money had been sitting out there for many, many years, unobligated and unspent.
Well, in a tight budget year, I'm sure that was good news to hear.
Yes.
Now, Auditor, we want to say that you're not running for re-election this year. Usually I have guests and I say, please don't talk about your election, but you're not running again this year. And you've spent decades serving the state of West Virginia.
I'm finishing up my 31st year in government and my 24th year as state auditor. And I came to the decision late last summer that it was time for me to step aside and let a new generation and new leadership come in. You know, I feel very good about what we have accomplished in the last 24 years. I think this OASIS project is going to serve the citizens of West Virginia well into the future. And it's just been a privilege to serve the people of West Virginia for the last 24 years.
State Auditor Glenn Gaynor, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
And congratulations, I should say.
Oh, thank you.
A small conference center and campground in Jackson County has stirred up plenty of controversy at the State House over the past few years. Members of the West Virginia Board of Education want to get rid of their authority of the Cedar Lakes Conference Center, but state officials aren't willing to pay the cost to let it go. This year, lawmakers believe they've found a compromise that lets the board off the hook while keeping Cedar Lakes open for the thousands of kids that attend camps there each year. Liz McCormick has more.
Last year, Governor Tomlin vetoed a total of 32 bills from the 2015 session. Of those bills, one would have made the Cedar Lakes Camp and Conference Center a nonprofit organization. Citing state budget concerns, however, the governor marked the bill red. Lawmakers are now attempting to revisit that issue this year in 2016. House Bill 4351 would transfer the Cedar Lakes Camp and Conference Center from the control of the State Board of Education to the Department of Agriculture. In the House Agriculture Committee this morning, the bill was passed out with no debate, but in previous years, things haven't gone so smoothly. Cedar Lakes is a 228-acre campground and conference center that's been around since 1949. It's used for a variety of things from hiking and fishing to a meeting place for groups like the 4-H. Since the site was established, it has been supported by the State Board of Education. However, after a 2010 audit, the board found the conference center was costing the State Department of Education more money than it was bringing in and wanted to get rid of it. Delegate Steve Westfall of Jackson County is the sponsor of House Bill 4351. Cedar Lakes is in his district, and 2 years ago, he attempted to convince the board to keep the conference center open.
Senator Carmichael and myself went to the State Board of Education and proposed a five-year plan to keep it open and to eventually move it from the control of the Education Department.
The 2015 bill attempted to make Cedar Lakes a nonprofit, but it was vetoed. In the governor's veto message, he said he supported transferring the Cedar Lakes camp into its own foundation. However, the transfer would create an unexpected increase in separation costs, resulting in substantial burden for the taxpayer. Cedar Lakes employees are all considered state employees, and when state workers leave public employment, West Virginia must pay them a separation package. That package includes a dollar amount for their built-up vacation time, among other things.
It's only like 22, 23 employees at Cedar Lakes, but some have been there 35 years or more. So my intent all along was to protect employees, but protect Cedar Lakes also.
This year's bill finds a compromise between the two. It would transfer Cedar Lakes Camp over to the Department of Agriculture, keeping it within the state's control. Westfall says he thinks the governor will approve it.
The governor has looked at it, and I think the governor's okay with it. He doesn't want to close it either. He's been to the facility and stuff, so it's great. I think it's sometimes you wonder why things happen with the veto of the bill last year, but I think now it's actually going to be better for Cedar Lakes.
House Bill 4351 now moves to the House Education Committee for further consideration. For the legislature today, I'm Liz McCormick at the Capitol.
Tomorrow on our show, the leader of the state's education system joins us. West Virginia Superintendent of Schools, Dr. Michael Martirano, will discuss the many bills lawmakers are considering that will impact education in the state, including a bill to repeal education standards Martirano and the State Board of Education have already replaced. That's tomorrow evening at 6:30. This has been the Legislature Today. I'm Ashton Mara. Thanks for joining us.
Support for the legislature today is provided by the following.
West Virginia University, online at wvu.edu. AARP West Virginia, your ally for real possibilities in the Mountain State. Online at aarp.org/wv. The West Virginia Higher Education Policy Commission, working to double the degrees produced annually in our state by 2025. Through increased opportunities for West Virginians to earn the credentials today's economy demands. The High Technology Foundation, building a stronger West Virginia, online at wvhtf.org. From West Virginia Public Broadcasting.